This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, the story of two murders by poison that gripped the attention of New Yorkers as the 20th century was about to dawn. The murders, the pursuit of the killer, and the ensuing trial proved a boon for the Big Apple's news moguls, Pulitzer and Hearst. But that's only part of the story. The murderer, Roland Burnham Molyneux, was the son of a Civil War hero. The motivations, they included a woman and a wounded ego. Our guest this afternoon is true crime historian Harold Schechter. He is the author most recently of The Devil's Gentleman, Privilege, Poison, and the Trial that Ushered in the 20th Century. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Harold Schechter, our guest, is a professor of American literature and culture at Queens College, the City University of New York. The author of fiction and nonfiction, his latest book, The Devil's Gentleman, is his 15th book. It is published by Ballantine Books. You'll find more information about our guest and his work online at his website, www.haroldschechter.com. S-C-H-E-C-H-T-E-R. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Harold Schechter, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure to speak with you. How did you first come across this story?
I actually came across it when I was researching an earlier book about a female serial poisoner. Named Jane Toppin, who was a Boston nurse who confessed to having murdered 31 people around the turn of the last century, and for many years was regarded as America's most prolific serial killer. Anyway, while I was researching that book, I kept coming across newspaper references to this other case that was happening simultaneously in New York City, and began to look into that and discovered it was a very, very fascinating case.
Yeah. It sure is. In The Devil's Gentleman, as readers make their way through, turning the pages, they will be reminded of some great American novels of the period.
Well, one of the things that drew me to the case, I mean, my day job is a professor of American literature.
Right.
And there were various literary connections between the Molyneux case and material that I teach in the classroom. First of all, the name Molyneux itself, one of the stories that I teach when I do Nathaniel Hawthorne is a story called My Kinsman Major Molyneux, which is one of Hawthorne's moral allegories set in the pre-revolutionary period about a young man named Robin who makes his first journey to Boston in search of his relative, whose name is Molyneux. And I was wondering if there was any connection between that story, which is to some extent based on historical reality in the Molyneux case, but then also the other, you know, the other very fascinating aspect of the Molyneux case to me was when I discovered that Theodore Dreiser had been very, very obsessed with the case and had originally intended to use it as the basis of the novel that ultimately became an American tragedy. Dreiser actually began a novel based on the Molyneux case called The Rake, which he abandoned after about six chapters, and then subsequently turned to this other very notorious murder case as the basis for an American tragedy. So, you know, those kinds of literary connections made the case very, very interesting to me.
Yeah. Well, is there any connection between Hawthorne then and Molyneux? And later in this story, there's a connection between one of the reporters.
Yeah.
Is the son, a son of Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Well, it turned out there wasn't any direct connection of the kind that I thought there might be. But as you said, one of the techniques that Hearst used to turn the case into this great media sensation was to hire very, very kind of celebrity authors at the time to cover the case. And one of them was Nathaniel Hawthorne's son, Julian, who, while lacking much of the talent of his father, was nevertheless a very, very popular writer mm-hmm. of mystery stories and horror stories and science fiction stories. And as I said, Hearst commissioned him to cover the Molyneux trial. And, you know, that sort of became a sort of device that, you know, media moguls continue to use today, where they, you know, will assign brand name journalists to cover these cases.
Mm. Yeah. Early in the book, The Devil's Gentleman, you tell readers that from an early age, Roland Molyneux put on the airs of a gentleman, and yep. his father, you say, looked upon that with tolerance, even a measure of pride.
Yeah.
Why shouldn't his boy aspire to the very heights of gentlemanly refinement? Yeah. And this is a turn on the American dream. Mm-hmm. Would it be fair to say that that in the case of Roland Molyneux, the dream is corrupted, it goes off the rails, it is an American tragedy, it's an American tragedy on steroids?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And, of course, I guess the American dream, you know, often has a lot of corrupt elements in it. I mean, one of the interesting things about the story to me, and, in fact, kind of the original draft I wrote of the book, which underwent some revisions, played this up a little bit more in the final version, had to do with the relationship between father and son. Because in terms of Roland's father, General Edward Leslie Molyneux, you really do see the dream, in a way, in its purest aspects, because he was a man who really did embody the best values of his time and place in terms of, you know, his industriousness and integrity and ambitions and, you know, really pulling himself up. And he was a self-made man in terms of his wealth and, you know, really a man of honor and distinction and nobility. And then he produced the son, who was kind of the spoiled, pampered ne'er-do-well. I mean, his father remained very, very loyal to him and, you know, had all these kind of blind spots, I guess, in relation to the worst aspects of Roland. You know, but Roland himself was, you know, just turned out to be this, for whatever reasons, this kind of spoiled, snobbish black sheep of the family who only valued the trappings of, you know, the trappings of wealth and prestige and so on and so forth. So he was kind of a hollow man, I think, Roland, in comparison to his father, who was a person of real substance.
Yeah. Well, tell us about Edward's service for the Union.
Well, you know, Edward, the father, was a genuine American hero who served very, very courageously throughout the Civil War, from the literally from the very moment of its outbreak until Appomattox, and fought in many, many famous engagements, suffered severe wounds, but returned to the battlefield as soon as he had recovered, and retired as his brigadier general, and throughout the rest of his long life, you know, remained very, very loyal to his former comrades and they to him. He was a revered figure in New York, and, of course, that was one of the things that made the case such a popular sensation, was the whole spectacle of this genuinely heroic figure having to defend his son of these very, very heinous crimes. You know, in doing my research, when I research these books, I write these historical true crime books, mm-hmm. I retain the services of a genealogist to help me locate surviving members of the families of both the victims and the perpetrators. And in the latter case, many family members aren't too happy about being identified or, you know, very cooperative. They, you know, don't necessarily want to be identified as the descendants of infamous murderers. But I made connection with some members of the Molyneux family, one in particular, Will Molyneux, who is the great-grandson of Edward Leslie Molyneux, and to whom my book is dedicated, who became a good friend and was an incredibly generous person and kind of a family historian who turned over a lot of archival material to me. And in doing research into the life of Edward, I kind of fell in love with the guy. I kept looking for his cold feet and feet of clay, rather, and couldn't really find any.
Because
he really was what he seemed to be, which was a kind of paragon of Victorian integrity and virtue and gentlemanly conduct. And, again, he was a much beloved figure, and the fact that he produced, well, he had three sons, but the fact that one of them turned out to be the central figure in what was the most widely publicized murder case of the time just seemed this terrible irony to everybody who knew Molyneux.
Yeah. How did the other two turn out, the other sons?
Well, they turned out to be, very, very upstanding and law-abiding citizens. I don't actually know very much about the younger son. Roland was the middle son, but the older one actually ran for the governor of New Jersey, and he was almost the opposite of Roland. I mean, Roland was a hedonist and very, very self-indulgent, obviously, and sort of flirted, aside from his crimes, flirted with all kinds of illicit behavior. He was a habitué of Chinatown opium dens and so on and so forth, whereas the older brother was almost priggish in his behavior, from what I understand. He was a teetotaler. He was the kind of person who apparently, when he would be in later years, driving around in his car, and we kept a broom in his car, I have been told, so that when he was driving through the streets, if there was any roadkill on the road, he would get out and brush it out of the way. So, one time I heard he was late for a very important appointment because he had the radio on, and they started playing the Star Spangled Banner, and he wouldn't leave the house until he had stood for the end of the Star Spangled Banner on the radio and so on. So he seemed to be the flip side of Roland.
Yeah. Can you tell us anything about the boys, their mother, Hattie Davis Clark Molyneux?
Yeah, this. Interestingly, I could turn up very, very little information about her. One of the things I learned recently, actually, after finishing the book, remember what the source was exactly, but some family member contacted me and told me that apparently, certainly in Roland's case, he didn't have that much to do with his mother. I mean, he was apparently raised mostly by nannies, so the mother was, very much out of the picture in certain ways. The real crux of, I think, Roland's emotional life and pathology, had to do with his relationship with his father. In the book, I try to avoid armchair psychoanalysis as much as possible, but it is hard to avoid, the conclusion that Roland, while constantly and very ostentatiously professing all this love and reverence and worship of his father, at the same time did everything possible to disgrace his father and undermine his father and financially ruin his father. So, you get the impression that this is a story about a young man who is really caught up in, in this very unconsciously, these very, very Oedipal issues with this very powerful, domineering, revered father in whose shadow he always grew up in.
Mm-hmm. Also, in terms of one of his intended victims, he had very strong feelings. And here again, you don't want to go too far as an armchair psychologist or psychiatrist, but I think you make a fairly good case that he was repulsed by his attraction.
Well, yeah. I mean, there are also, there are all these elements of homoeroticism that enter into it. I mean, some very, pretty explicitly in the sense that Roland, at the time the case was unfolding, there were all these insinuations about his being a, as they said back then, moral degenerate, partly because he resorted to poisoning, which is seen as a crime exclusively perpetrated by women, but also other, there are other reasons as well. So there was some suggestion of that. But I think, more than that, in the case of both his victims, both the men he murdered. You can certainly see elements, again, of the same kind of Oedipal issues. You know, in one case, there's this very, very powerful man who is threatening to take away Roland's love object. And in the other case, there is the director of the athletic club, who is also this very powerful man, that Roland had this really inordinate and almost inexplicable hatred of from the very beginning. I mean, you really do have to look at some kind of deep psychological roots to account for Roland's hatred of Harry Cornish.
Yeah. Before we get into some more of the specifics of the case, maybe we could talk a little bit about New York City at the dawn of the 20th century, late in the 19th century, in the 1890s. You mentioned that the boys had nannies and that the general was a man of some means. What was the family station in 19th century New York, and how important was class in New York late in the 19th century?
Well, the thing about the general, the Molyneux family, they were, the general himself was a tradesman, really. He made his fortune in the paint business, and he was, quite wealthy for the time, even after he had spent quite a substantial chunk of his fortune in the legal defense of his son, which was an ordeal that went on for at least 3 years. You know, he did, as I understand it, die with a substantial estate. But nevertheless, he was certainly not of, the very, very upper crust. It was an age that was obviously obsessed with wealth, an age that was obsessed with material success, an age that elevated the self-made millionaire, to the sort of highest level of cultural, aspiration. Little boys back then grew up. This is the era of the Horatio Alger, boys' book series, and, the era of Andrew Carnegie, et cetera, et cetera, and his whole, gospel of success. It was an era when little boys were looked up at the self-made millionaire in the way that previous generations would look at military heroes or whatever. So, at the very, very top of that pantheon was Mrs. Astor and her 400, whose doings were constantly being recounted in the popular press for the delectation of the audience. So, Roland always presented himself as a member of the very, very upper crust, but he was not a blue blood by any means.
Yeah. How did his peers view him?
Well, apparently he was always seen, even among the members of his very, very snobbish athletic club, as being somewhat of a peculiar individual. There's something sort of subtly unnerving about him to many people. At least that was what they reported, after his arrest, that there was something about him that made people uncomfortable. Now, exactly what that quality was is hard to say. But he did also, even among this very, very snobbish crowd that he hung out with, had an extremely supercilious manner that put people's teeth on edge.
Yeah. Among all the stories that you've written about now, the cases that you've written about, the true crimes, how does he stack up in the pantheon of villains?
Well, there are certainly many more heinous murderers than Roland Molyneux.
Mm-hmm.
In my earlier books, I deal with some of the more infamous serial killers in American history. Some of those people are genuine monsters. One of my books, for example, a book called Deranged, was about a pedophiliac cannibal named Albert Fish, who was at large in the 1920s and really, well, even going back probably 20 years earlier than that, you know, the early decades of the 20th century. And not only was this a man who preyed on scores of young children, but, you know, committed the most unspeakable sorts of tortures on them. So, I mean, in that sense, yeah. You know, Roland's crimes per se, did not rank among the most awful that have been committed. Actually, that's one of the things that's very interesting to me as a historian of crime is, one of the things I discover in my researches is that there are always these horrific crimes that are being committed, mm-hmm. At all times. And the vast majority of those get very, very little attention in the press, and the public really doesn't seem to be particularly interested in them. You know, you can see that today. Last summer there was a hideous crime committed in Florida where a group of teenagers broke into the home of a woman and gang raped her and forced her to perform oral sex on her 12-year-old son and then blinded the boy, by rubbing Drano into his eyes or whatever. And, that made the newspapers for a day or two. And then other crimes that are much less unspeakably awful, not to diminish how terrible they are, but nevertheless, something like, let's say, the Leopold and Loeb murder, mm-hmm. Where you had the abduction and killing of a single boy. And the rather swift murder of the boy, he wasn't subjected to prolonged torture or whatever, become these crimes of the century. And it's of interest to me, why certain crimes mm-hmm. achieve that kind of cultural status.
Yeah.
The same thing is true of the Roland Molyneux case. I mean, he poisoned two people, but there were many, many other cases of poisoning and many cases back then of, dismemberment, murder, and all kinds of horrific crimes. So there are these other elements that go into making them cultural sensations, and that is, what is of interest to me.
Yeah. Well, what made this a sensational case in its day? And, let's take it from there.
Well, again, a large part of it had to do with, as you were suggesting, matters of class and so on and so forth. I mean, the fact that the principal suspect in the case was the person he was, and the son of this revered figure played a large part in it. One of the things that I discovered actually when doing that earlier book I mentioned, the Jane Toppin case that led me to the Molyneux case, was the extent to which poisoning back at the turn of the last century, during the Gilded Age,
mm-hmm.
Exerted the kind of fascination on the country that serial murder does for us. In other words, the figure of the serial murderer who haunts, our nightmares and has become this kind of mythic monster for us. Back then, there were serial killers back then, too. They didn't call them serial killers, but the crime that we call serial murder is obviously not new. It extends back to the very beginnings of our species and possibly even predates it. But occasionally, the newspapers would report some horrifically mutilated body that had turned up or whatever. But those kinds of crimes somehow didn't resonate with the public back then. But they were very, very obsessed with poisoners. Partly, I think, because there was so much anxiety back then about the kinds of substances people were ingesting. Nobody knew whether whatever they were putting into their mouth was going to kill them at any given time, because there was no regulation in terms of the food industry. There was no regulation in terms of medicine. The marketplace was flooded with these patent medicines that often contained very, very toxic substances. And, in fact, even the medications that were prescribed by legitimate physicians also contained lots of poisons. If you look at the original Merck manual, one of the resources I used in my research was the first edition of the Merck manual, going back to 1898 or 1899. And it's really hair-raising to see the kinds of things that doctors would prescribe for common ailments. you know, if a baby had colic, you know, they would suggest giving them the baby a teaspoon of formaldehyde, you know, and arsenic and strychnine and other poisons were very, very common medications that were prescribed. You know, so people, again, there was this general sense of the toxicity of things you were putting into your body. And I think that the poisoner became, you know, the kind of personification of all these anxieties about them, about, you know, again, the danger of all these things you were putting into your mouth.
Yeah.
So, you know, here was this, you know, this poison case involving the son of one of New York's most revered figures, and you know, Pulitzer and Hearst, who had already seen their circulation of their newspapers skyrocket whenever there was a particularly juicy poison case, just saw this as you know, this amazing opportunity to you know, to turn this into a big media circus.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Harold Schechter. He is the author most recently of The Devil's Gentleman, Privilege, Poison, and the Trial that Ushered in the 20th Century. Our guest is a professor of American Literature and Culture at Queens College, the City University of New York. He is the author of fiction and nonfiction, and he's a true crime historian. This book, The Devil's Gentleman, tells the story of a man who committed murder by poison, and the story gripped the attention of New Yorkers as the 20th century was about to dawn. The murderer, Roland Burnham Molyneux. He was the son of a Civil War hero. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, when we look at the sensational crimes and the trials of our time, where do you see, what do you see as our anxieties, the anxieties of our day? I'm curious.
Well, I mean, I think that the serial killer became a particular monster for us during the 1970s. I think partly it reflected a lot of fears about sexual dangers, because some of the early serial killer stories, particularly people like Ted Bundy and so on, you know, had to do with this, you know, fatal attraction to these strangers. But I think, you know, my theory is that, you know, Freud talks about horror being the return of the repressed, things that we repress and don't want to look at coming back to haunt us as these nightmares. And if you look, for example, at Victorian England and a character like Dracula, you know, the story of Dracula has a great deal to do with the return of the sexual repressed. All of these taboo sexual issues that the Victorian era didn't want to look at become, you know, take the form of this monster that, you know, will creep into your bedroom and unleash all of this, you know, filthy, licentious desire in you. For us, this is an observation that's been made by other people, but what sex was for the Victorians, death really is for us. You know, death is this terrible taboo subject that we don't really want to think about, and we'd like to pretend that we are somehow indestructible, you know, that if we do enough push-ups and, you know, go to the gym often enough and have enough cosmetic surgery, you know, we will, our bodies will never decay and be destroyed and so on and so forth. And to me, the serial killer is this nightmarish reminder that our bodies are going to be taken apart and devoured. That's what Hannibal Lecter is to me. You know, in The Silence of the Silence of the Lambs, to me, is sort of similar to Ingmar Bergman's The Seventh Seal, you know, where you have the night playing this game with death.
Yeah.
And I think there are a lot of a lot of anxieties having to do with the destruction of our body, with our flesh being turned into carrion, with our flesh being turned into, you know, dead meat that the serial killer stories are expressions of.
Yeah. Also, it seems interesting to me that we are also very concerned about what we put into our bodies. If we take the right supplements, if we eat the right foods,
yeah,
we're going to
forever. Well, we are, but that's true. But I think much less to the extent that people were back then. In fact, just last week I was in San Jose, California, and I was in an antique store, and I came across an old ad for Emerson's Bromo Seltzer, which, of course, is something that figures very prominently in The Devil's Gentleman. And it was from exactly this particular era. And the ad said, you know, whatever, you know, Emerson's Bromo Seltzer. And then in very large letters, it says, contains no cocaine or morphine, as a way of reassuring, you know, consumers about its ingredients. So, you know, the mere existence of that ad, you know, confirmed this belief of mine that people were just very, very, very worried that, the medications, the foods, whatever, that they were ingesting were going to have all these very, very, very destructive substances, which many of them, in fact, did. You know, when one of Roland's victims, Henry Barnett, fell ill and the doctors examined him, they discovered all of this, these traces of mercury in his mouth and his throat. It was clear that he had ingested mercury, but it didn't set off any alarm bells for them because people were ingesting mercury all the time back then with legitimate medications. Mercury was one of the main ingredients in Calomel, which was a very, very common, popular over-the-counter medication that was prescribed for all kinds of ailments. So, you know, that's the difference.
Yeah. So then it's not really until Harry Cornish becomes ill, but first of all, his landlady, Catherine Adams, takes some of the poison accidentally, and she dies. So that's why we have a trial involving the death of Catherine Adams, the murder of her,
right,
and not Barnett.
Yeah. I mean, Harry Cornish, who was the athletic director of the Knickerbocker Athletic Club, and this individual that Roland just harbored this, again, extreme, inordinate, somewhat inexplicable abhorrence of from the moment he set eyes on him almost, had received in the mail a bottle of what appeared to be a sealed bottle of Emerson's Bromo Seltzer with a little silver holder. He took it as a kind of joke that some other member, some friend of his, had sent him during the holidays, you know, as if to say, I know you're going to overindulge during the Christmas holidays, so, you know, here's something when you wake up with the inevitable hangover. And Cornish brought that bottle of Bromo Seltzer back to his apartment, and as luck or bad luck would have it, his landlady woke up a few days later with a bad headache and took some of the Bromo Seltzer and instantaneously collapsed, as Cornish said, like 6 foot of chain, and died within minutes, really. And the reporters for Hearst and Pulitzer, who at that time served also as private investigators, really, in competition with the police, quickly turned up the fact that this other member of the Knickerbocker Athletic Club, Henry Barnett, a former friend of Roland's, had also died an agonizing death about a month earlier, or a few months earlier, after having received and taken some headache medication in the mail. And the common denominator between the two men, as the papers quickly discovered, was Roland Molyneux.
Yeah. Also, now we get to the part of the story that involves some sex. Blanche.
Yes, Blanche.
Blanche. We can't leave her out of this abbreviated telling of The Devil's Gentleman. Tell us about her. And here we see in her character One of the ways in which the Victorian era is beginning to fade.
Yeah. Well, Blanche was a young woman, very, very free-spirited, who at the time of this event was living by herself in New York City, which was, you know, a somewhat scandalous circumstance, at least in the eyes of some of her relatives. You know, Blanche was a little bit of a pioneer. I mean, she was foreshadowed, really, the generation to come, you know, the so-called flaming youth of the 1920s. But, of course, she was in her own youth in the 1890s, which was still a very, very repressive period in many, many ways. But she was an interesting woman, Blanche, had all these artistic aspirations, had a very, very good singing voice, and aspired to be an opera singer. And again, a free spirit who was eager to divest herself of her virginity and to experience the pleasures of sex, which, by the way, one knows, because I was fortunate enough to get my hands on this unpublished memoir that she wrote later in life,
mm-hmm.
in which she, you know, talks in some detail about those earlier years. And Blanche met Roland on board a yachting expedition, and saw in him. I mean, Roland was a very, very, very attractive fellow. There's a photograph of him in my book, which is the only extant photograph of Roland, which was one of the things that I was lucky enough to receive from Will Molyneux. And, of course, he was very athletic. He was a champion athlete, an amateur athlete. And Blanche was quite taken with Roland, not least because she also, because of his money. Blanche was one of Blanche's dreams to go to Europe and take the grand tour, and she felt that Roland could, you know, afford her all these luxuries she craved. So she, you know, she and Roland became an item, but there was something about Roland that she found somewhat off-putting, which was, as she would put it, this kind of some mysterious lack of virility. He seemed to lack a certain kind of male aggressiveness, and Roland introduced her to his friend Henry Barnett. Barnett, although not at a glance nearly as attractive an individual as Roland, he was somewhat paunchy and so on, nevertheless possessed this, again, what Blanche always describes as this male element that Roland seemed to lack. And an attraction very quickly developed between her and Barnett, and Blanche ended up kind of breaking up with Roland and engaging in this long-term affair with Barnett.
Yeah. One of the things that I thought of reading as I was making my way through this part of the story was, you know, here, another novel, The House of Mirth.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, there are a lot of connections between Wharton and this world. You know, when I originally conceived of this book, in fact, I think the original subtitle that I was toying with had something to do with Murder in the Age of Edith Wharton or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But you do see, you know, you certainly see affinities.
Yeah, well, Blanche Cheesbrough, she had a much longer life than Lily Bart, but there are certain similarities in their circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, Blanche came from an interesting background. She, you know, her father was also kind of a quintessentially American figure. I think in my book I compare him to Colonel Sellers in Twain's novel, The Gilded Age. You know, he was a schemer and inventor who always felt, you know, that his great fortune was just around the corner, and dragged his family all around the United States in pursuit of one opportunity after another, none of which, of course, ever really materialized. And as I said, Blanche was kind of left to her own devices pretty much from a fairly early age. She had a couple of sisters who had married very, very well, one in particular who took her under her wing and, you know, did her best to try to, you know, to try to find her wealthy husband for Blanche. But, you know, Roland, you know, was what she ended up with.
Yeah. Another one of the things I want to talk with you about before we're out of time is the coverage of the trial in the press.
Yeah.
The Herald sent its theater critic, Clement Scott, to cover the trial, which it sounds like might not have been a bad thing after all, the way he described the defendant.
Yeah.
What do you make of that? And is this the beginning of how sensational trials were covered in the 20th century and into the 21st?
Well, you know, sensational, you know, the newspaper sensationalism to some extent begins somewhat earlier. I mean, if you look at, for example, the Helen Jewett murder case in the 1840s and the way it was covered by what was then called the Penny Press, you certainly see foreshadowings then, but not to the extent that you do at this time. I mean, the subtitle on my book is Privilege, Poison, and the Trial that Ushered in the 20th Century, and the reason I called it that was not only because the Molyneux case, which lasted from beginning to end over 3 years, literally spanned that period from 1898 to 1902, really, but because so many of the traits that seem to characterize and also that seem to many people these sort of deplorable symptoms of our own particular cultural moment, you know, you see back then, primarily the way in which the boundary between news and entertainment is completely blurred, and you know, in the assigning of Clement Scott and the assigning of Julian Hawthorne in running literally, you know, what were essentially comic strip versions depicting, let's say, the death of Henry Barnett, you know, you see even back then all of the characteristics, you know, that define our modern tabloid culture, you know, where there's just, again, all these horrific crimes and cases and sensational stories are turned into nonstop entertainment. You know, the only difference really between then and now is technological. But Hearst and Pulitzer certainly are both pioneering those things.
Mm. Also, it was fascinating to learn later, after the case was over, we have a theatrical telling of this story.
Yeah.
Can you tell us just a little bit about this play that apparently was not successful, The Man Inside?
Well, The Man Inside actually was the play that Roland wrote, which wasn't a version of this story, although I think people sort of expected from the title that it would be.
Uh-huh.
But there were, you know, again, analogous to the kinds of things you find today. There were these instant books that were based on the case. As you said, there was a play, title now escapes me. I can't quite remember what it was. But anyway, it was a very, very thinly disguised version of the case, which sort of, in this version, it turned out that Harry Cornish was really the murderer that was immediately rushed out to exploit the public fascination with the case. Roland himself, you know, in the way that people do nowadays, well, both Roland and Blanche, really, tried to exploit their own notoriety. Blanche tried to go on the, you know, on the vaudeville stage and promote herself on the basis of, you know, her being the person she was. I mean, she was trying to promote her singing career by appearing on the stage, and Roland wrote novels. I mean, not specifically based on the case. Roland wrote these very, very, these kind of bodice-ripper novels. And also, as you said, David Belasco, who was the main Broadway impresario, produced his play, The Man Inside, which was, again, not specifically based on his case. Mm-hmm. But he did write a book called The Room with the Little Door, which had to do with it, the 18 months he spent on death row in Sing Sing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, whatever. I mean, you see this all the time. You know, it's like, you know, this woman who is just caught up in the Elliot Spitzer case, you know, now getting paid $1 million to pose nude for Hustler, whatever. You know, again, that phenomenon you see certainly as far back as the Molyneux case.
Yeah, really fascinating. We are out of time. Thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Harold Schechter is the author most recently of The Devil's Gentleman, Privilege, Poison, and the Trial That Ushered in the 20th Century. Our guest's name, spelled S-C-H-E-C-H-T-E-R, for those of you who like me to do that, there you have it. And you will find our guest online at www.haroldschechter.com. The book, The Devil's Gentleman, is published by Ballantine Books. It is 1:53 Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from Kansas City and Chicago. Here's Todd Gleason.
Well, thank you very much, Celeste. After a big down day yesterday with limit moves lower in the corn and the wheat and the soybeans, futures moved back higher today on what many will term a turnaround Tuesday. May contract 32.5 cents higher in the nearby wheat, $11.70. The high, the low at 11.19¾, up 32.5 cents. A final price today at $11.64. That for the May soft red winter wheat in Chicago. July futures, the harvest month there, 11.40 the top, the bottom at 10.85¾, the settlement price at 11.85, up 36 cents. And September futures, 11.50 the high, the low at 10.95, settlement price at $11.45, 20 higher. December futures, 11.58¾, the high, the low at 11.05, settlement price at $11.54, 29.5 higher. And the March contract in the wheat pit, up 28 cents today at $11.62. From the corn pit, nearby May contract gained 8 cents, $5.49½, the high, the low at 5.28, settlement price at 5.47¼, up 8. July 5.62, the high, the low at 5.40½. Settlement price 8 cents higher at 5.59¼, and September futures 5.63 the high, the low at 5.42¼, settlement price at 5.61½, up 8¼. December corn futures 5.63 the high, the low at $5.41½, settlement price at 5.61¼. Your new crop settled up 6¼ for the Dease contract in the March corn pit, 5.72 the high, the low at 5.51¾ for the futures there, 5.69¼, the settlement price up 6¼ for the March corn. May futures up 8½ at 5.77, and the December of 09 at 4¾ higher, settled at 5.38½. May oat futures at 3.79 top, bottom at 3.58, settlement price at $3.78, up 5½. And July futures a 5 cent gain, a nickel higher at $3.87 for July oats. From the soy complex, nearby May soybean futures, $13.19 the high trade for the day, the low at 12.52¾, settlement price at $13.07, up 4¼. July at 13.33¾ top, bottom at 12.68¼, or rather 12.68¾, and their settlement price at $13.22, up 3¼. August soybean futures 13.26¼ the high, the low at 12.61. Settlement price at $13.16, a nickel higher for the day. September futures up 16 cents, 12.94¼ the high, the low at 12.25. September settled at $12.90, once again 16 higher. November beans, new crop, 12.46½ the high, a low at $11.79. Settlement price at 12.40, up 11, and the January futures at 12.55 top, bottom at 11.91. Jan bean settled at $12.51, a dime higher. November 09 down 7 cents today, 11.87 the high, the low at 11.37. Settlement price a lot closer to the top, still lost 7 cents at $11.80 for the November 2009 soybeans. May bean meal futures now, $336.90 a ton the high, the low at $316.40, settlement price at $330.50. Up $6.70. July futures up $5.90, with a top at $3.41.50, a bottom at $3.22.60. July soybean meal $3.35.70, a settlement price up $5.90. July bean oil, a settlement price at $59.14. That's down 0.18 cents for the day, with a high of $59.90 and a low at $57.32. Once again, the settlement price for the July bean oil at $59.14, down 0.18 for the day. And the May bean oil, $59.24, the high, the low at $56.56. Settlement price at $58.40, down 0.16 on the afternoon. That's a look at the numbers from the CME Group's Chicago Board of Trade. We'll be back with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange side of the group here in just a moment. Don't forget to stay with us this afternoon at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock this afternoon, just about 9 minutes away now. We'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of New Market, Indiana. I'm Todd Gleason.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Mike Morris and McHenry at 815-344-7213. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
And the livestock contracts today at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange finished on the upside. April live cattle, 91.40, the high. 90.15, the low. 90.95, the settlement. That up 172.5. June, 91.75, the high. 90.55, the low. 91.50, the settlement. That up 152.5. August, 95.05, the high. 94.30, the low. 94.87.5, the settlement. That up 95. October, $100.60, the high, $99.87.5, the low, the settlement, $100.37.5, that up $1. March feeder cattle, $99.55, the high, $99.30, the low, $99.45, the settlement, that up $35. April, $103 even, the high, $102.20, the low, $102.52.5, the settlement, that up $82.5. May, $105.70, the high, $104.60, the low, the settlement, $105.62.5, that up $180. And August, $109.40, the high, $108.40, the low, $109.32.5, the settlement, that up $137.5. April lean hogs finished on the downside today, down 35 cents, the high, $56.40, the low, $55.42.5, the settlement, $55.57.5, again, that down 35. May, $66.85, the high, $66.10, the low, the settlement, $66.67.5, that up 32.5. June, $71.85, the high, $70.65, the low, the settlement, $71.60, that up 45. July lean hog, $75.60, the high, $74.55, the low, the settlement, $75.40, that up 25. And May pork bellies, $80.20, the high, the low, $76.52.5, the settlement, $76.52.5, that down $3. Let's take a look now at the Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P 500. And at 1 minute before 2 o'clock, the Dow is up 319 points at 12,291. The NASDAQ up 59 at 2236. The S&P 500 up 42 at 1319. And the price of a barrel of oil up 132 at $107. You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our technical director this afternoon is Henry Frayne. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson. Let's take a look at Mike Sola's forecast for our area. In the WILL severe weather coverage area, an urban and small stream flood warning is in effect for Clark and Cumberland counties until 9:30 tonight, and a flood watch is in effect for Champaign, Christian, Clark, Coles, Cumberland, Douglas, Edgar, Macon, Moultrie, Piatt, Shelby, and Vermilion counties through tomorrow morning. Mike's forecast for Champaign-Urbana, that flood watch in effect through tomorrow morning. This afternoon, cloudy with drizzle and occasional showers. The high around 55, then steady or slowly falling. Tonight, cloudy and breezy with showers and a chance for isolated thunderstorms this evening. Then occasional showers after midnight. The low 35. The wind tonight from the north at 15 to 20 miles per hour. The outlook for tomorrow, cloudy and breezy with a chance of a few showers during the morning. The high 47. The wind from the north at 15 to 20 miles per hour. More on the weather during the closing market report that follows the news. Stay tuned.